Do you follow Vabysmo, Faricimab, SVOA, on LinkedIn? You should. Stay current with our latest updates and hear from leading experts as they share their real-world experiences. Search Vabysmo, that's V-A-B-Y-S-M-O, on LinkedIn to find out more and give us a follow. Content is independently written and developed by HCP Live.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us for this MedCast series, where we'll be talking about addressing suboptimal response for patients using anti-VEGF therapy in neovascular AMD and DME. I'm Shruthi Arapalli from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia.
And I'm Hongwin Hua, Assistant Professor of Clinical Ophthalmology at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute.
So today, the two of us will be interviewing Dr. Rishi Singh, who's the Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at the Cleveland Clinic Martin Hospital in Stuart, Florida, and getting his opinions on how to approach these difficult patients that don't respond completely to anti-VEGF therapy in AMD and DME. Dr. Singh, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started into our questions, I think it would be really nice for us to define what a sub-responder is or an incomplete responder. And so how do you approach that with your patients when you're discussing therapy?
Yeah, I think that there's really two definitions to this. There's sort of the practice definition, and there's ones we've used in studies and trials and publications. So the practice definition for us has always been a patient who has a persistent pigment fluid attachment, continued intraretinal fluid. Sometimes we look at it and say it's the frequency of treatment, which, again, these are not great definitions, but this is probably what a lot of us prescribe or what think to in clinical practice is regarding the definition of suboptimal responder. But then when you go to the actual studies, and you have been authors on them, and I have too, where you look at some of these studies, usually it's a less than 10% reduction in retinal thickness or a less than five letter gain in visual acuity. That's usually considered a suboptimal responder in a lot of the studies. And there's been a lot of good work done on even quartiles of response or tertiles of response, kind of looking at that and seeing those patients who don't gain vision or even lose vision in some of these anti-VEGF studies. So there's a little bit different definitions. And again, for the disease state, it may differ as well. So there's differences there between AMD and DME, but there are some good definitions out there that we can sort of follow from a practice perspective.
And you raise a really good point about how there's a difference between AMD and DME. When you talk to your patients or when you meet them for the first time, do you have in your mind an initial conversation of what your endpoints are or goals are for therapy between the two?
Yeah, that's one of the conversations I have a lot with people. I usually say something along the lines of, I'm going to get to know you really well over the next year because the frequency of treatment is very high within the first year. And then obviously you can extend out over time. You know, I think that the unfortunate or fortunate thing, you can look at it on both sides of the coin, is that fortunately we have good therapies that improve vision. Unfortunately, without high frequency, we really don't get the optimal response. The average number of injections in the real world for AMD and DME is less than 4 a year. We see some patients getting 3 and 4 a year, essentially by Iris Registry data, by Vestrom data, by data that's been published in claims. So people are not getting what's necessarily within clinical trials. And I think that's because the burden is so significant from either a socioeconomic standpoint or basically from their ability to get the drug efficiently in practice. Those are major barriers for them to get the drug optimally in a frequent nature.
That's definitely a great point between, you know, real world setting and clinical trial setting. Perhaps in the real world setting, how do you differentiate between the suboptimal response and lack of durability?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in DME, I think, you know, we try to drive toward a thin retina, but then we're willing to accept visual acuity as being an endpoint. So for example, if a patient has decent vision, 20/25 vision, and they've got, you know, maybe a not so great retinal thickness, we're still willing to accept that because we think that we can at least continually treat them. We're getting obviously the diabetic retinopathy response, which also is helpful. So we're willing to tolerate some fluid, I think, more so in DME. In AMD, we know that it's a bad prognosticator. We want to drive toward a drier retina. So I think there's obviously that difference in those two disease states. We want to try to flatten the PED. We want to try to get all the intraretinal and subretinal fluid out first and foremost. Those are the key drivers, really, is the intraretinal fluid first, the subretinal fluid probably second, and the PED probably third. But regardless, we try to get the retina to the driest state possible in AMD versus DME. We probably would be able to tolerate at least a little bit of fluid for good vision.
I think these are really important points. I think one of the things that I am learning how to navigate with patients is setting their expectations and explaining why they may not be a responder or responding as strongly as we like. In your experience, do you have something in the history on exam or on OCT that makes you think this patient may not respond as well as I'd like them to and kind of helps you set the stage for their therapy?
Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, if you look at the data from the non-response studies that have been done, the big one really is baseline visual acuity or baseline retinal thickness. Those are kind of the big ones. The more thicker the retina is, the more likely it's not to respond quickly to the therapy. The worse the visual acuity is, it's not going to be responded. I mean, maybe those are not necessarily causative, but associative, but that's what we kind of see. Honestly, we haven't found that silver bullet, though. That's the problem. With all these patients we see, whether it's race or whether it's ethnicity or whether it's you know, fellow eye presentation, none of them seem to really pan out. So unfortunately, it's like Russian roulette every time to determine what their frequency is going to be like. You never know it's going to be 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, or 12 weeks based upon the patient. So we just have to talk about it. And then what compounds the fact of patients with bilateral disease, that becomes even tougher because then you could have one eye on one frequency, the other eye on the other frequency, and you try to, you know, kind of minimize the visits, albeit you're sacrificing one for the other. So you're having to get to where you can kind of find a mean steady state between the two in order for you not to have the patient come in for separate eye visits every time.
Yes, yeah. I'm definitely still figuring out my own practice pattern myself. In terms of managing your patients that are suboptimal responders, how do you figure out what time frame you're going to consider switching to another therapy? Has your time frame changed recently?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first and foremost, I think looking objectively at the data is very important. I've had the pleasure of having you both in my clinics before, and you know, one of the things you don't get to look at is the longitudinal history of the patient. Like, so when you go back and look at their initial presentation and then you see, okay, fine, they did better. They got a retinal thickness that was improved. We've seen the fluid by the B scans or by the OCTs go away. Then we know we're on the right track, right? But we still have persistent stuff left over. So what do we do then? Well, we can decide if that persistence, at least in DME, is worthwhile going after, or is it worthwhile just or is it worthwhile addressing? And in AMD, we obviously want to try to address it. So the first thing we do is drop the interval. So I always drop the interval to 4 weeks for a lot of those patients with any of the approved agents. And I usually, again, try to migrate to the approved agents versus the off-label agents. I think, you know, you all trained at Coli where we had a lot of benefit of really good drug in Avastin or bevacizumab and practice. We don't have that always, you know, in our practices now. Now I'm using an off-label agent made by a compounding pharmacy. I have no idea where it's made or how it gets to me or even if it's very efficacious. So I try to first switch to a branded agent if the unbranded is not working. And then I also drop the frequency to 4 weeks. And if that doesn't then make the difference, or I'm at 4 to 6 weeks with that branded agent, which may be a first generation anti-VEGF, I then migrate to either the higher dose agent, which we have available now through aflibercept high dose, the 8 milligram dose, or we can go to faricimab and use that drug instead. So we have options now, thankfully, but in the past, we sort of had to wait till we hit that, you know, the precipice of saying it's not working anymore.
Yeah, that's a really great explanation. I think, you know, as patients come into our clinics, I don't know if you've been experiencing this as well, but, you know, sometimes they'll read about drugs. They're very intelligent. They know a lot about it. And they'll say, can I start on faricimab or can I start on a high dose of aflibercept? Are there patients where you'll consider starting with those right away? Or do you kind of like to keep the same algorithm up to a certain point?
Yeah, that's a big difference between Midwest Ohio and South Florida. I get a lot of New York types down here, and they're very, very smart people. And not to say that Ohioans were more, I think, just saying, well, whatever you think, doc, you should do. But the New Yorkites, they really are people that have looked at the literature. They've read something. They had a friend on something. Maybe it's the cachet of going on something, I don't know. But they come in with a lot of expectations on the newer agents. And I think there's also been some direct-to-consumer marketing, right, that's been out there. I think that that's been, unfortunately, not the greatest marketing, because it's been saying to people, well, you can go up to 16 or even 20 weeks on a drug, when you know and I know that a very small portion of those patients always go into those percentages in the real world. So there are patients I would use the newer generation agents on. Those particular ones have been with pigment epithelial detachments. We've seen some objective data recently that's shown us that some of the second generation anti-VEGFs and Ang2 combination drugs have a better effect on the PED status. We know that obviously if the duration of interval is so short with a fellow eye, we may consider that as being potentially the reason to go with a newer generation anti-VEGF. And I had a patient actually just recently that showed up in my office in Florida, where the fellow eye was injected with a first generation anti-VEGF every 4 weeks. She'd lost vision. She had a discoform scar. So she really wanted to consider a newer agent. So we did start her on aflibercept 8 milligrams for that eye instead, to see if we get, again, a better anatomical outcome earlier, so she didn't lose vision. That was really what she wanted to do for her.
And speaking of, what has your experience been with transitioning to the suboptimal responders or these treatment naive patients to faricimab, to the dual anti-VEGF and Ang2 inhibitor?
Yeah, they've been better. I think that's all incrementally better by maybe 2 weeks or 4 weeks sometimes with some of the agents. In naive agents in particular, I've seen some really great responses. Whenever you start off with them in naive states, you can kind of see a much better response, which makes me think that maybe we should have probably started early on these patients. But unfortunately, like in Ohio and in South Florida, we have a lot of step mandates and we have a lot of hoops to run through. So it's not so straightforward that we can go straight to those, second generation agents. We sometimes have to stop and do even off-label agents, sometimes biosimilars before we get there. And then we have to be able to then graduate to these others. So it could be a few shots to a year before you get to the other agents. But, the ones I've started naively when I was up in Ohio and down here, I've actually been probably the most impressive to me of all in comparison to those patients we had to start off, who were the kind of recalcitrant patients who you always are difficultly treating, and you're trying to get them a little bit longer, and you only get like a week or two more, which is fine. I mean, 2 weeks is a big deal. I mean, if you can get 2 weeks or even 3 weeks from a patient, that's a big deal for them, because it does decrease the burden, does decrease the visits, does decrease all the socioeconomic issues that the patients face coming in each month.
Yeah, I think those are really great points. And exactly like you're saying, our studies were on naive patients mostly. So that's where we're getting those really phenomenal results. So getting back a little bit to these sub-responders or people who are incomplete responders, we've talked about thickness and a few other things that when a patient comes in. But, I really like to pull up imaging for the patient, as I know you did too. You taught us well. What do you point to when you talk to them to show them that, yes, maybe you're having a little bit of a response, but not quite enough?
Yeah, so I think that thankfully with OCT and really the databases and the kind of image analysis software we have, it's made a huge impression in patients. So we can now look at retinal thickness over time. We can look at B scans over time. We can show them even on a graph. We used to show, where the retinal thickness started from and where it's ended up now. And showing that, I think, has been very valuable to the patient to educate them on that. When I decided to move down to Florida, one of the things I was really making sure I had when I started was a really good image management software, because I think it's so great to kind of show the patient the progression of the disease over time, and making sure you can track things like, both IRF and SRF and even the pigment epithelial detachment over time is valuable to show the state of the retina. And sometimes showing color images can be very valuable too. I've become more of a color image fan, to be honest with you. I used to not take as many color images when I had patients, just because of the throughput. I was just, moving them right along. But then I realized now with some of the patients, color photographs are valuable, because you can see a patient when you start off with maybe a very large, drusenoid PED with hemorrhage around it. And then you can show them the progression over time when you take a few photographs later that shows them hemorrhage has gone away. So, you know, I try to photo document most everything. I've stepped away from angiography, to be honest with you. I used to do a little bit of angiography up there, even now down here. I do some, you know, I don't do any actually, because I don't have the people to do it right now. And it's very hard to kind of get them with that. Sometime I will do it. But even when I was in Ohio before I left, I was playing around with oral contrast fluorescein, which I thought was valuable. Actually, you can just look and see, just to make sure you don't have a masquerade syndrome. And that's the thing I think you're looking for with any angiogram at this stage of the game is, you know, if your anti-VEGFs are not treating the patient, you have a suboptimal response. The next step is, you know, do you have a variant of some sort, whether it's polypoidal or whether it's some other retinal condition with exudation that doesn't appear to be necessarily AMD or DME? You know, central serous is a big masquerade as an example. So really getting an angiogram on those sort of patients can be valuable for you to kind of, you know, make sure you don't, you know, treat that sort of patient. But it's only after a suboptimal response, you're really pulling at those sort of, those techniques to kind of find those patients.
Makes perfect
sense. That's definitely one of my first things that I like to do when my patient comes into the clinic, pull out the OCT and show them what's going on. When you have a patient and you're showing them the images and they're not responding as well as you want them to, and they say, Dr. Singh, what's going on? I thought this would take me out to 12 weeks to 16 weeks. How do you have that discussion with them, and how do you get continued buy-in for their treatment?
Yeah, so I talk about, you know, the overall state. Again, I try to show them the longitudinal benefit there. And, you know, even if they haven't achieved an interval that they're happy with, I reassure them that we will try to keep pushing for a longer interval. I mean, there's nothing to say that a patient can't be treated frequently, then be extended, then be retracted, then be re-challenged again. There are patients like that. And mm-hmm. So I think that people need to understand that this is a very artful way of looking at the OCT, looking at vision, trying to titrate out the treat and extend regimen that's perfect for them, and then make sure you get the best, you know, optimal interval for them, where you maximize the gain, minimize the fluid, and maximize their benefit in regards to coming in to seeing you. So those are just some of the ways that I try to encourage them. I try to tell them that, you know, we will continually try to push. And, you know, honestly, the good news about this, as you both know, is that there's lots of drugs around the corner that are really exciting that are going to come out that are going to either be implantable, maybe subretinal delivery, maybe suprachoroidal delivery, something that's going to come out there that's going to extend the interval even further. And they're all going to be additive to what we have right now, which is really great to see.
Yeah, I think having this arsenal for our patients just makes it more and more hopeful, because it can sometimes be a very difficult discussion when you're inheriting them. I've got one last question. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about these newer agent drugs, and I'm sure that you've been at these conferences and heard about these reading center studies, but in particular about faricimab. And I, you know, I see a lot of uveitis. I'm always interested in inflammatory diseases. And we've seen from a few researchers that faricimab might have an effect on sort of inflammatory markers or epiretinal membrane formation or exudates in patients with diabetes. How do you feel about that? And how is that kind of panning out in your practice?
Yeah, so I gave a talk this year at Angiogenesis just on some of the studies we've seen to date on the anatomical endpoints that may suggest Ang2 effect versus what we see in with a VEGF mediated drug. And there are a couple, as you mentioned. So first of all, the PEDs, less epiretinal membranes, hyperreflective foci, which is probably the inflammatory marker that is most impressive, is decreased in those patients with angiopoietin 2 and anti-VEGF versus anti-VEGF alone. And, you know, again, the drying effect has been better with both drugs together. If you look at the totality of evidence right now, it seems like the drying effect within that loading period between the Ang2 and the anti-VEGF, which is given, in, you know, again, at the same time frame, you can really match up and say that this is definitely an anatomical benefit to the patient. So we're seeing a lot of good objective data on that. I think to your point about, you know, utilizing more research-related tools or, you know, artificial intelligence-related measurements of these patients, that's coming. I mean, I think that the software is definitely going to be embedded within our systems. We're going to see more of that in the near future. We don't have it now. And so we kind of use these kind of poor rudimentary biomarkers. I think we're going to see in probably 5 to 10 years, we're going to start to talk about nanoliters more often in meetings and such. Like, oh, my drug decreased the retinal thickness by 5 nanoliters or 15 nanoliters versus saying words like, well, it decreased the central subfield thickness by 50 microns, because the thickness has almost zero to no correlation with the amount of fluid. And so I think that we're learning about that kind of lack of correlation and what that means. And we're probably going to end up using these volumetric measurements of fluid more often as it gets embedded in the software. It becomes more easier to ascertain. We're going to probably discuss those a little bit more in practice.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes in the next 10 years, just like you said. Well, Dr. Singh, thank you so much for spending the time educating us on your practice patterns and how you approach these difficult patients.